It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum. I am the host and creator of LeadingLDS.com, an online resource to help us figure out what on earth we're doing as leaders in the LDS Church. And today is another segment of the How I Lead segment on this podcast. And today I have a special guest, so special because not only is he a bishop, he is also one of my old, probably ranking up there on the top of the list of favorite mission companions. We served together in the Sacramento, California mission in roughly 2001 to 2003-ish, and we were Spanish missionaries, and we were in a small town in California called Tracy. And to be honest, it was probably one of the best times of my mission because neither of us were leaders in the mission. We were just good, hardworking missionaries that were able to do a lot of good. And so that is Joseph Valdez. How are you, Joseph?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Good. You do have positive memories with me in the mission, right?
Of course. You were definitely one of my favorite companions.
Oh, good. Good. And we got a lot of good work done in Tracy. And
Tracy was a lot of fun.
I'm sure there's multiple Spanish stakes because of our hard work there now, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a branch reward there. Yeah. Stake now.
Yeah, and back then we would just... We would sit in the back and translate the English meeting as into Spanish as the handful of Spanish saints, I guess most of them were Mexican, and I think some from Ecuador had headphones on. And I remember the week, and this is maybe after you left, when one man started to recite the Constitution of the United States, and I was expected to translate that. And as you remember, I was a young missionary, and my Spanish was not that great, and never really. Anyways, that was a good learning experience. So
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, you know, the crazy things that happen on the mission. So now, Joseph, you're originally from Houston, Texas, if I remember right. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was actually born in Albuquerque, but I moved to Houston when I was 3 years old.
Okay, and you're born and raised in Texas, right?
Yeah, I was born in New Mexico, but raised in Texas, yeah.
Okay. And you went to the, even though your last name is Valdez, you're as white American as they come, right?
Right. My dad's family is actually Spanish, and they came over with the conquistadores to New Mexico, and there was just pure Spanish blood, so we're...
Oh, okay. So some Spanish descent. And then I remember after our mission, there was a moment we were hanging out, and you were telling me about this Brazilian lady that you met, and you were smitten by her, and you ended up marrying her, and she drug you down to São Paulo, Brazil, and you've been there ever since, right?
Yeah, that's about 11 years ago. I met her. She has family that lives up in Utah. While they were living in Utah, they went down to Houston, lived there for like 3 years. I became really good friends with them, and then they moved back to Utah, and their cousin went to go visit them, and when they came back to visit Houston, to visit their old friends, they brought their cousin, and we just kind of met, and that was history.
Nice. And now you've been there. You went there not knowing really any Portuguese other than having a strong background in Spanish from your mission. And now you're fluent in Portuguese and currently serving as bishop.
Right.
Nice. Cool. Well, maybe tell us about a little bit about your upbringing. I'm going to play dumb here. Obviously, we've had many long chats on the mission and afterwards, but your upbringing in the gospel, in Houston, Texas, the development of your testimony, what stands out most to you as you think about growing up in the church in Houston, Texas?
Well, I was born in the church. My parents were both converts before I was born. My mom when she was 16, my dad when he was in his late 20s, and then they married and when they were about in their mid-30s, and I was their first son. And they were really good examples of living the gospel. My mom was very dedicated. She had several leadership callings. She was more of a leader in the family, and she was very dedicated. I remember waking up several nights and watching her preparing for classes and preparing for activities and whatnot. And my father was actually a good example of faith. And we had some trials growing up and with different problems, mainly money issues. And everything would work out after he would say a prayer and miracles would literally happen. So watching that, I was able to really grow in the gospel. I had great leaders. I came from a very strong ward, strong stake. My seminary teachers were just awesome. Young men leaders were great, and they really lived the gospel. They really taught it, and they were great examples. And I went to a school of, and my high school was about 2,000 people or so, all the students. And there was only a handful of members, maybe about 20 or so, but we were pretty tight-knit, and we stayed together and tried to watch out for each other.
Cool. And then when it came time for you to go on a mission, was that a difficult decision, or did it just natural?
It was pretty simple. It was pretty natural. I graduated from high school. I knew I had a year left before my mission, so I took some college classes, and I just knew the next decision was the mission. It was just a natural choice.
Nice. And I remember you always enjoyed learning the Spanish language and had a passion for it. When you found out you were going to be speaking a language, is that something you were excited about? Or
something I always knew that was going to happen ever since I was a little boy. I remember there was a primary activity where they brought together a lot of people from the war that served in different places, and we would go around each room and everybody would explain where they served their mission in the different countries that they had served. And I remember thinking, I'm going to serve a Spanish-speaking mission, because I really felt close ties with my ancestors and with the Spanish blood that was in me. So I knew I was going to serve a Spanish-speaking mission. I just didn't know where. I figured it would be in the United States because I had a really strong asthma, and so I knew that I would have to be careful with that. But so when I was in high school, I really tried to learn Spanish. I talked to people in Spanish and tried to I made as many Mexican friends and Spanish-speaking friends as possible to be able to speak with them all the time. So,
cool. And then, again, going back to, we talked about how you got down to Brazil, and now you've been married, you said, I think, 11 years.
No, 10 years.
10 years, okay.
Yeah.
So how would you describe the phase of life you're in right now? I know you've got a handful of kids down there.
Yeah, it's pretty hectic. I have four kids. They're ranging from 1 to 13 months to 9 years old. I have a pretty hectic job. I commute 4 to 5 hours per day.
Wow.
And then serve a lot in the ward. So.
Okay. And maybe tell us about kind of the makeup of your ward there, and I'm extremely, you know, ignorant to, you know, maybe how the church works there, just because I've never been to Brazil. I've never really experienced the church outside of the United States. And so maybe tell us the basic makeup of your ward, how many members, the geography of it, and so forth.
I live in a really big city. It's the population density is really high, I guess. And so the area that we're in is probably, you can drive from one side to another in about maximum 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Probably five. Yeah, so it's a small area. We have around 700 people on our rolls. But we have a attendance of around 120 to maybe 160.
Okay.
So this will fluctuate from month to month, depending on the time of the year.
Okay. And how long does it take to get to the closest temple where you're at?
We have a temple in São Paulo. It would probably take 40 minutes without any traffic by car, an hour and 20 minutes by bus and subway.
Oh, okay. Cool.
But during rush hour, it can be up to 3 hours. So.
Wow. And growing up in the church in the United States, in Houston, which obviously has a good population of, I don't know, I mean, this church isn't necessarily totally weak there, and from my understanding. What surprised you the most, or how would you say it differs from going from Houston, Texas to São Paulo, Brazil?
What really interested me when I got here was that everybody knew each other. The whole stake knew each other. There was a lot of stake activities. It seemed like every week there was a stake activity for some organization. And you would go there and everybody was friends. And that was kind of different for me growing up. Our ward was maybe 200 to 300 people. And we really didn't have a lot of exposure to the other wards. We did when I was maybe 14 to 15 for a little bit, but it was very little, and you really didn't develop a lot of friendships with people outside of the ward if you weren't in a state calling.
Huh. And would you say that is the fellowshipping there is a little bit is more heightened primarily because of just the culture? They're generally more of a social culture, or is it more just that geographically the wards are closer? What, any idea there?
I think it has to do with a little bit of both. The culture, people are very open. They like to make friends. They're very friendly. They'll invite you to their inside their homes. And that's one of the reasons. The other reason would be because it's a very small area. I remember in our area in Tracy, we could drive literally from one end to the other. It could be 4 hours. We didn't work that far, but we stayed in a small geographical area, but our area was literally that size. And here you could probably drive from one end to another in about 20 minutes, 30 minutes maybe. And so that's one of the reasons. But another reason was there's a lot of members that have been here inside the church for a long time. There's a lot of pioneers. It was started with two small wards, actually branches, Vila Maria and Jassana, and they kind of grew up into this stake. And so a lot of people know each other because of they have roots in these branches.
And then, go ahead.
Sorry, and they've developed friendships over the years, so.
Nice. So let's go back to when you were called as bishop. We were actually called as bishop around the same time. And if I remember right, you were on the high council prior to that?
Yeah, I had served, I think, maybe a little over 2 years on the high council.
Okay. And maybe tell us about how you were called to the High Council, you know, the story of how that happened, and then how that transitioned into being called as bishop of your ward.
Okay. Well, I was serving as a counselor in the bishopric, and I had served for a little bit over a year and a half or so, and we had a very good bishop, and he liked to train future leaders. He wanted to make sure that there was enough people trained so that they could be called bishop when he was released. And so his father was a pioneer, had been bishop three times, and he saw his father do that as bishop, so he wanted to make sure that he did that. And so I was probably his third counselor. And so the first two counselors had been counselors for a very long time for previous bishops, and so he called me to train me, and then I guess he wanted to call another person and started training him, and then I guess he wanted to move on and train another person, so I was called to the High Council, and it was an interesting experience because my first Sunday I was assigned to a ward that wasn't doing so well, and they didn't have a high priest group leader at the time. So I kind of, after a couple weeks, I kind of took over as a temporary high priest group leader in the ward. And, but they soon realized I was studying, full time, and I was working full time, and I had two small children at the time. So they quickly assigned another person to take on that responsibility. I started serving another ward and serving with the young women, and that was a fun experience, going to women's camp and helping out the young women leaders and make sure that the girls had a really spiritual experience. And after about a couple years, we knew that our bishop was serving for around 5 years, and it was time for him to be released. But I wasn't really expecting to be called because there was really a lot of good men that could be called instead of me. And it was actually funny. I was called on a fast and testimony during a fast and testimony meeting. It was the first Sunday in January, and so the stake president called me as a bishop, and then he had me bear my testimony, had the prior bishop bear his testimony, and then let everyone bear their testimonies as they felt like it. And a lot of people got up and said, you know, I really didn't expect Joseph to be bishop, but it feels right, so I support him.
Nice.
So it was a really interesting experience, and you could feel that it was the Lord's hand in it, and that it was done by revelation. So it felt right.
Well, I'm sure if we went back to 2002 in Tracy, California, and saw us two running around mindlessly trying to figure out how to do missionary work, we would be shocked that we would both be bishops someday. But nonetheless, Revelation's weird that way. So cool. And now it's been, what, you're just about 4 years? At the end of the year, you'll be at 4 years?
Right.
Okay, cool. And as I do in these interviews of how I lead, I've asked you to maybe think about, just five key leadership principles that if you could get in a time machine and go back and tell yourself at the beginning of this journey as bishop or really any leadership calling, those things that you tell yourself. And so let's maybe go through those. The first one you said was, it's always about the master's will. Maybe elaborate on that.
Yeah, it's always about what the Lord wants. I kind of learned since I was young, I've had a lot of painful memories caused by myself wanting to make certain decisions on my will and what I want. And that's really been hard for me during my life in several moments as a growing up as a teenager and on the mission and afterwards. And I kind of realized that I cannot put the trust in myself, that I need to depend on the Lord. And this is His church. This is His work, and I have to do what He wants me to do.
Nice. You know, and that's perfect. I know when in any leadership calling, sometimes as the administrative work comes flying at you, and then the ministry work gets mixed in there, and soon you're required to make decisions so quickly. I find at times it's hard to step back and be like, okay, what truly is the will of the Lord in all of these decisions? So I think that's great.
Yeah, and we have our word is about 120 to 160, but it's hard to fill up all the callings with that amount of people. So we'll go through a lot of a high turnover rate in some callings because people are going out, moving, and whatnot. And so sometimes you want to make decisions based on certain criteria, certain variables. Well, this person is stable. This person's been here for a long time. He knows the ward. And you just kind of go with what he wants. And it works better.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm sure you feel like you're maybe taking a chance with certain people and certain callings, but at the end of the day, there's not maybe a long list to choose from, but it's always amazing how that works out.
Right.
All right, then the second point you said is build from the basics. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I was called as bishop, I had this plan that I developed, and I wanted to implement a lot of plans. So there were different strategies to get the work done. And so I would build a plan to get homing teaching done. And then I would build a plan to make sure that everyone was reading their scriptures. And we would build a plan so that we could reactivate members. And basically we wouldn't use the tools that the church provides, which are great tools, because we were trying to implement these plans. And they were big plans. They were projects that could go from 3 to 6 months. And everybody would get excited, and after 2 or 3 weeks, we would discover that, look, the excitement kind of fizzled out, and we decided, look, it's not going to work, so let's go on to the next one. And after a couple attempts, I kind of realized that everything is there. Just need to do what the church has provided. So it's basically follow the church handbook, use the records that they have. They have the reports for new members, for reactivating people. They have the meeting set up so that you can work together with the leadership to do the Lord's work. And by small and simple things, you're able to do great things. And so, as Alma taught.
Right. And that's such a good, I think that's a great perspective to have, is I am totally falling into that trap where sometimes I'm reinventing the will, or I'm creating my own home teaching program, or doing this overburdening task to the ward members, when in reality they already have enough to worry about. They already have plenty of tools to go from, and it just kind of muddies the water. And even with leading LDS, I'm always catching myself thinking, you know, you're not trying to develop another tool or resource that is going to replace tools that already have, that are, the church already has in place. And so I think that's great. And I fall into that trap, especially early on as bishop, where I was just thinking of this great new idea that would change it all. But in reality, we should just build off, like you say, the basics. Take the home teaching program that's in place. Take the scripture study, family home evening, prayer, and focus on that and build from there and help people, again, turn their focus back there. So great perspective.
One of my counselors, he was just called as in the stake presidency. He would talk about a time where his mission president, when he was on the mission, his mission president would set goals for them, and they would pray that they could reach the goals. And they would sometimes go to the mission president depressed that they didn't reach the goals. He said, well, we talked about doing this, 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 and this. What did you do? And they would talk about the projects they would do and how, the ideas that they tried to implement. And he would say, but did you do what we talked about, where we said we would make, I don't know how many contacts and get as many referrals as we can? And they said, no. Well, he said, we'll do that. And then after that, we can talk about why you're not reaching your goals.
Yeah, exactly. Do everything that's in under our control to hit those goals, right?
And so I think it's just basically build from the basics and everything will fall into place.
Cool. Next one you said is do not act out Satan's plan. That's, I think, solid advice.
Yeah. And this is something that I've really been thinking about the last couple of years. And it's basically based on the council in heaven. And when Heavenly Father presented the plan, he presented a plan that would give us all free agency, and we were expected to use the free agencies, and some of us could fail, but it was the best plan possible to make sure that we could reach the potential that we have. And Satan, he presented a plan that would kind of stop this free agency and obligate everyone to do what needed to be done to progress, to return to live with our Heavenly Father, and we get the glory, of course. And I think sometimes as leaders, we want to kind of take away the free agency of the people that we lead, and we want to kind of force them to make the right decisions. And we kind of act out his plan in that way. We have to be careful and make sure that we give them a free agency, they're able to use it, and that we need to trust that this is Heavenly Father's plan, that this is his will, and that eventually they will come to the right decision. It might hurt a little bit on the way, but they will arrive.
Yeah, and I think this is a very valid point. And I don't know, is there a specific example that comes to mind as maybe what this leadership looks like when you're not forcing someone to make the right decision?
I kind of remember when we were having a problem in the stake, and there was a problem in the stake where there was a certain business idea that was being thrown and people were running into it, trying to, kind of like a get rich quick idea. And people were getting loans and they were using their influence inside the church so that they can, kind of grow within this, business idea that, was being thrown out to people. And there was a lot of bishops that wanted to go in and kind of like force it to stop. Of course, you have to avoid that this happens at the inside the church. This is the church is not exactly for business. It's about growing spiritually. But they wanted to go and just stop it and kind of like force everyone to stop practicing the business idea.
Yeah, like a mandate over the pulpit,
yeah, exactly.
Saying this is forbidden, stop it.
You could probably tell my English is really bad after 10 years in Brazil, but
I'm sure if we were doing this in Portuguese, you'd be much more comfortable. But sorry, I don't speak it.
Yeah. But and so you set out a mandate, make it stop, and you forget that we need to teach the true doctrine. And if we teach doctrine, people will change. And it might not be right away, but eventually they'll change and they'll realize that they need to stop doing what they're doing. And this will give them the free agency that they can act and not be acted upon, and that they can grow.
Perfect. And that's, let me see, going back to your five leadership principles, maybe we can jump to that one as well. As the fifth one you said is help others to act and not be acted upon. And that maybe plays into that same idea, right?
Yeah, I think all the principles are really linked together in some way. And I think as a leader, you need to create people that will act for themselves and be leaders for themselves. Kind of the purpose of the website Leading LDS. And the plan of salvation is basically is to make people progress so that they can act for themselves and not be acted upon, and they can be more like Heavenly Father, more Christ-like. And we need to develop people as leaders. A lot of times we will counsel with them. They'll want answers, and we might have the answers, but we need to think of ways to help them get the answer for themselves and not just spoon-feed the answer.
Yeah.
Elder Bednar talks about this, and he talks about inspired questions, which are basically open-ended questions that will help the person to think, and they're usually related with some type of doctrine and principle.
Yeah, perfect.
And so,
you mentioned Elder Bednar. Acting and being acted upon. I've written about it many times on Leading LDS, and he has spoken about that many times. And obviously, it is scriptural based. Comes from 2 Nephi 2:14. I just pulled it up here, and it says, "And now, my sons, I speak unto you these things for your profit and learning. For there is a God, and he hath created all things, both the heavens and the earth, and all things that are in them are both things to act and things to be acted upon." And the more I've delved into that principle and understood that, it's really empowered me as a leader, empowered me just really to set my perspective straight on what I'm doing in life in general, that making sure I'm an agent of action and not being acted upon by other forces. So I think that's sound counsel.
And this is important too, because a lot of times when a new bishop is called and or old bishop is released, members will go away because they don't like the new bishop, and some will come back to the church because they didn't like the old bishop. And that would kind of go away if we're able to develop people so that they can act for themselves and they put aside these feelings that they have towards other people, and they're not acted upon by these feelings.
Yeah, perfect. And then lastly, put treating everyone individually. Do not go to extremes of always or never unless it's an absolute truth. Maybe expound on that for a minute.
Yeah, this could be maybe 2 points, actually. But basically, we develop plans. We've developed routines based on our experience, based on what has worked in the past. And so if we brush our teeth, for example, after every meal, we're going to have clean teeth. And so we have this routine that's going to work. And so we develop these routines, and sometimes we try to use them with everybody that we talk to. And so when the person comes in, he has a problem that we've dealt with before, and we used this certain plan and it worked well. We try to follow this plan maybe use the same doctrine that was being taught, the same inspired questions to try to help this individual. And sometimes it's not, or a lot of times it's not what that individual needs in that moment. That person can need something different. And so we need to be really careful and say, well, this routine worked in the past. It's always going to work. Or this didn't work in the past, so it's never going to work. And there's not really, that's not really an absolute truth. Absolute truths are sure, are definite, and they will always exist. And those we can follow, but certain routines, certain plans, certain strategies to help out individuals might vary from person to person.
Yeah, it does. It makes me think of Elder Bednar's book. We're giving Elder Bednar a lot of love here, but he deserves it. I read his book, Increase in Learning, and with that book, he put out a few different video segments where he is talking, I think, with some young adult groups, where they're doing kind of a Q&A. And in that book, he talks about this concept of a lot of times when we teach in the church, we talk about applications of this is how I apply this principle, the gospel. And so when in reality, we should be talking about doctrines, which is at the other end of the scale, because doctrines lead to principles, which lead to applications. And where a lot of people will start with applications and then go to principles and doctrine. But if we start with the doctrine, then we allow everybody, once they understand the doctrine, which are a lot more of these absolutes, they can then end up at their own application, how they see fit. And so in these video segments that Elder Bednar put out with this young adult group, I remember, I forget how exactly he put it, but he basically focused on the doctrine, and there was this desire for people to kind of say, well, no, tell us what you do. Like, how do you apply that in your life? And he just said, well, I'll tell you how I apply it, but this works for me, but it may not work for you. And it's up to you to determine how that doctrine is applied in your life. And it's just like perfect. Because in leadership, there is that temptation where somebody may come into your office with an addiction or concern, and it's like, oh, well, this is what I do. You know, just try that. You'll be fine. And in their world, it just doesn't work. And so I think that's a great, great counsel to, you know, let everybody be the individual they are and approach problems, how they find successful, and it's your job as maybe the leader to help guide them to really what that looks like. So,
right, and I think this is very true for ourselves too, because sometimes we want to use the same techniques to motivate ourselves. For example, what is motivating me to read the scriptures right now, I might want to use this in the future, but I'm at a different point in my life where I need a different type of motivation.
Yeah. Yeah, the old tools just don't work. So, cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about just the more practical side of your leadership. Maybe tell me what your typical week looks like from Monday morning to Sunday night. Like, what meetings you have during the week? How do your Sunday meetings look? And that type of schedule.
Okay. Monday is family home evening, so that's pretty much at home. Tuesday, I go to the church for interviews, and basically I set up a couple of interviews and allow people to come in for temple recommend. If I'm free, I'll go and play soccer, or now the youth are playing basketball, so I'll play basketball with them.
That's the Joseph Valdez I know and love right there.
Yeah, I got some youth that fell in love with basketball, so it's been fun lately.
Cool.
So, and then I'll spend some time with them. Wednesday nights, I will maybe try to go make some visits. Lately, I've spent a lot of time at the church on Wednesday nights because my wife is preparing for the dance festival. that they have every year in the stakes here in Brazil. It's kind of like the road show where you have plays, but here it's their dances.
Oh, wow.
And so she does the choreography for those dances, and she's been working on them on Wednesday nights. So I've been there supporting her.
Good.
On Thursdays, it's basically another night of interviews, and I try to set up interviews. Maybe I will go make a couple of visits, and again, I will if I have some free time, I will probably spend it with the youth playing soccer or basketball or watching them during their dance rehearsals and other activities. And so Friday night, usually we leave them open, but sometimes there's a few activities. I think once a month we have a ward missionary activity, just kind of like an open house where we have different types of things set up so that people can come and bring their friends. And Saturdays, we can have some activities. For example, Mutual is on Saturdays. Once a month, we have temple trips. And we'll set up the couples night once a month on Saturdays. And so those are fun to let all the couples get together and have like a date night where one couple will talk about relationships and then they will have a game for all the couples and then kind of like a dinner. And the kids are being watched by the young men or young women, a young woman or young men. And so that's fun. On Sundays, I get up and I have my first meeting at 6:30, which is the bishopric meeting. And then at 7:30, we have PEC. That would be three times a month. On the fast Sunday, we have the ward council at 7 a.m. And so we won't do the bishopric meeting on that day. And then after we have the services at 9 to 12, and then basically it's just interviews and administrative meetings, talking to people, seeing how their families are, and closing out tithing. And then during the afternoon recently, I've been spending a lot of time Sunday afternoons with my family. I'll try to get in one or two visits, or I'll try to I'll have stake meeting sometimes, but I've been trying to spend as much time on Sundays with my family as possible.
Nice. Cool. Well, it sounds like you're a busy bishop, as most are, for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. So, but
so as you balance all that, a busy schedule, have you put in place any specific technology that you use, maybe that you use to communicate with your bishopric? As on your ward council, what sort of technology, what apps, those types of things do you find yourself using in your calling?
Basically, I've been using the regular calendars app to set up all my agenda so that I know who I need to talk to and what I need to do. I don't really use a special app for that, but I use a lot of Google Drive. I used blogs in the past to try to put up meeting minutes, and we would restrict the access so that only the leadership would get have access to it. But that was kind of hard to handle or to maintain. So we've been using a lot of Google Drive, where we'll put certain actions on spreadsheets. And we'll limit the access to maybe a couple people, and they'll go in and know what they have to do, and they'll go ahead and fulfill those actions. But basically, that's what I've been using as of now.
Cool. And now let's move on to the holy grail of church leadership, which is home teaching and the greatest experiment in humankind of motivation and moving groups to do something uncomfortable. So what are your thoughts on home teaching? I'm sure you've spent some time thinking about it in your time serving in leadership callings. Any unique approaches in your ward, things that you found have worked, that don't work, and so forth?
Well, we've really tried to focus on the doctrine after reading Elder Bednar's book, Creeds and Learning, and the other books. It kind of got an idea that you really need to focus on the doctrine. And so I was kind of pondering and trying to see what doctrine is behind hope teaching. And it's basically the doctrine that we need to represent Jesus Christ as priesthood holders, and we need to represent him and minister as he ministered, so that we can become more like he is, and we can exercise our free agency for good. And so we try to really emphasize that and highlight that as our main purpose for doing home teaching. And that's helped a little bit. And we've tried to really emphasize every month in the different meetings that people need to go and do their home teaching. Sometimes when we have a new elders quorum president or a new high priest group leader, they'll want to go and change the companions, and that will help. But basically what's really is been the strong foundation is this doctrine, that what we're doing is to represent Christ and that we need to minister as he did. And I think that's helped people to understand what they're doing. And we've also implemented, not implemented, but we've put into place a program where we need to live 5 points of the gospel. And this was based on Elder or President Faust's talk and was passed on to, by the area presidency 5 or 6 years ago. And we've emphasized that the home teachers need to teach or emphasize these 5 principles so that families can be strengthened and they can be stronger during these trying times. And those 5 principles are family home evening, family prayer, family scripture study, tithing and fast offerings, and temple.
And so with that approach, you've kind of tied it into the focus of home teaching then.
Yeah, we've emphasized that the home teachers have to represent Christ and help the people that they visit, the families that they visit, to live these principles so that they can have strong families.
So as you've now served in various leadership callings for, probably majority of your married life anyways, how has serving as a leader made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
I think what it all comes down to is the realization that he knows us. And the meetings I've participated in and talking about people and their needs, you come to realization that he knows each individual. Even that person that maybe is not on everybody's minds, that nobody really talks to, that's kind of far from everybody. He knows that person. He'll inspire the leadership to think of that person, and he'll inspire the leadership to know what that person's needs are. And I've really come to know more Jesus Christ, the little I know him, is that he knows us individually, and he ministers to us individually through the leadership and through others. And so that has given me a stronger desire to want to minister, to help others, and to represent him wherever I am. A couple years ago, Elder Bauer talked about this in a general conference when he said that we should try to do or to help an individual each day. And we should pray and try to pray to find that individual that needs to be helped on that day. And that's kind of helped me to become more like him in the little way as possible, because I'm not like him at all, but it's helped me a lot.
And that concludes this episode of How I Lead on the Leading LDS Podcast. I encourage you to reach out to a past mission companion if you had the opportunity to serve a mission and renew that friendship again. And I always appreciate my friendships that I gained as I was in the service of the Lord, especially those that were also in the service of the Lord. I encourage you to stop by leadinglds.com, check out some other articles and resources there. I'm constantly looking for other leaders, Relief Society presidents, Elders Quorum presidents, ward mission leaders, high councilmen that I can maybe sit down and talk with and share some unique perspectives that you've gained as you've been serving in your calling. While you're at Leading LDS, I encourage you at the top of the page, there will be a link to join the Leading LDS community, and that we can join together and make a better resource for Leading LDS. I do not want to be the only voice on this resource, and so I need the help of other leaders out there that know much, much more than I do to share, to participate as much as possible so that we can truly build the kingdom more effectively through leadership. Because truly, there's only one problem in the world, and that is leadership, to quote Sterling W. Seal. Until next time, be a leader, not a calling.